Hello, I'm Scott Gregory, producer and editor with Studio Tulsa, which is just about to get started right now, but I had a quick note on tonight's interview. We're discussing the Underground Railroad with Richard Blackett of the History Department at Vanderbilt. He is to give a lecture here at TU. That lecture has been rescheduled on account of the weather. The lecture was scheduled for tonight at 7. It will happen tomorrow night, Thursday night, the 21st at 7 p.m. in TU's Lorton Performance Center. And for more information on the rescheduling of the Barnard Lecture, please go to the TU Facebook page at facebook.com/utulsa.edu.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today will be giving the Barnard Lecture in History this evening. Historian Richard Blackett is the Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and a specialist on the transatlantic abolitionist movement. As the sesquicentennial American Civil War continues, this year the University of Tulsa's history lectures will be focusing on various aspects of this conflict. Professor Blackett's lecture will look at a number of courageous African Americans and few white Americans who worked on the Underground Railroad in the South in the years leading up to the Civil War. In the Belly of the Beast, the southern arm of the Underground Railroad, takes place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus and is free and open to the public. Richard Blackett is the co-editor of the series Anti-Slavery, Abolition, and the Atlantic World, published by the Louisiana State University Press. He's the author of a number of books dealing with the transatlantic abolitionist movement, both here in the United States as well as in Europe and especially Great Britain, and the role played by African Americans in the struggle to win support for their struggle against slavery and discrimination. His most recent book is titled Divided Hearts, Britain and the American Civil War. It's published in 2001. He's currently at work on a study of the ways communities on both sides of the slavery divide organized to either resist or support enforcement of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, and the way slaves, by their escaping, influenced the debate over the future of slavery. He'll be speaking again tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus. Richard Blackett is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Blackett, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Your speech for the Barnard Lecture, as well as some other lectures you've been giving, has been looking at a reassessment of the Underground Railroad. Now, most Americans tend to think of this as a fairly organized society of people who secreted escaped slaves to the North, sometimes and later, especially after 1850, all the way to Canada. How organized was it? How should we reassess what actually happened in the Underground Railroad?
There was some organization, although it is not national in scope. It's clearly much more organized in specific local communities where runaway slaves gathered or knew where to go. But that has now become the traditional or standard view of the Underground Railroad. That is, it operated in the North to aid slaves who were running away to reach some form of safety, either within those communities, in other urban communities, or alternatively in the security of Canada. That has become the conventional view of the Underground Railroad. What I am proposing to do, the questions I plan to raise and to address, is whether we should look at a broader view of the Underground Railroad. That is, people who went south to encourage slaves to escape, for instance. Slaves in the south who remained there but nonetheless aided others to escape. And free blacks in the south who also aided slaves to escape. So those are the kinds of approaches that I'm going to look at.
Really, you know, we think of the Freedom Riders as being a 1960s invention, but people from the north came into the south and were able to operate?
Well, clandestinely.
I mean, yes.
They took their lives, in, as the Freedom Riders did, they took their lives into their own hands and in some cases died for it or had to endure very lengthy prison systems when they were caught. So, no, this is a dangerous business and people undertook it with the knowledge that they could get themselves in deep trouble, but they did it. And these are blacks and whites.
Yes, right. I would think either way, especially if a white person was working, just the social networks that were part of the South where an outsider would be so easily known suggested that it would have been a very, very difficult undertaking.
But the person, it may be easy to identify an outsider, but how do you identify somebody who is coming into the South as an itinerant trader, for instance? And they were all over the South. Or teachers who are coming to teach either individual Southern families, the children of Southern families, or in Southern schools. These people possibly could harbor anti-slavery views and in some cases use that as a cover to do their work. And the only reason we know this is because they were caught. Now we don't, which means that there may have been many more others. And if you look at reports of slaves running away, at least from the Southern perspective, there's always the comment that the South is being invaded by these crazies.
So it was really a secret agent mole sort of situation, wasn't it?
That is exactly the word that I use. They are moles and they are subversives. They are moles who are actually living in the South, and these tended to be free blacks. And who had always been, who had been free for extended periods of time, but who used the cover of their freedom to aid slaves to escape. So they are moles and they are subversive, and the subversives are those who come in under the guise of some other occupation, whether it is a traveling salesman, a teacher, a coal porter, people selling books and selling religious tracts. You know, these are people who are using this to aid slaves to escape.
Now, what was the reaction of Southern authorities? You mentioned earlier that when you examined their writings, they were, felt like they were being invaded by these, quote, subversives.
Well, they used the court as the first line of defense, and the courts sentenced people. So if you look at records of the state penitentiary for any, particularly border states, you would find countless people in prison for aiding and abetting slaves to escape. And some of those people were outsiders. Now, we can't tell if they were, in many cases, if they were outsiders only from the court records, but those court records are voluminous, they're very detailed, and they tell you where people were born. They even tell you the color of their hair, their occupation, their height. It's very detailed. So you can use those court records as a way to get into this particular problem.
When we think of the Reconstruction era, once the courts were no longer available to enforce white supremacy and keep African Americans away from their rights, we think of extra legal means of, like, the Klan. Any sense that in this, leading up to the Civil War, there were also extra legal organizations sort of investigating these?
Well, not of the kind of horrific nature that we've come to associate with the Klan. But people attempted to defend themselves. They created organizations, the purpose of which were to ensure that that their property was protected, that if one of their slaves escaped, that they had a pool of money to pay slave catchers to retrieve them. They had sort of organizations that police the borders, particularly the river towns. So yes, there were ways, and also state legislatures passed a number of laws that attempted to put up a barrier between slave states and free states, particularly along the Ohio.
Now, the second category you mentioned were actually slaves who would stay on their plantation or in their guise as a servant and indentured worker, and helped other slaves escape. This sounds pretty fantastical.
Well, it might be, but it's true.
Yes.
And the reason we know is that some of these slaves who aided, in fact, if you read newspaper reports, although they may be a bit paranoid at times, they would tell you that they know there are organizations among slaves, the purpose of which are to aid others to escape. They say it in the newspapers. And we have accounts from slaves who actually escape who make mention of the fact that there were other slaves who hid them until such time as it was safe for them to leave, sometimes for months, at serious peril to their own lives and safety.
Absolutely, so, I would think. And just the fact that if there are more mouths to feed, that, you know, I mean, I would think there would be just a myriad of ways. I would think that the owner would feel no compunction about going anywhere within slave quarters to search, for...
Well, some of these people were... But they tended to be in urban areas.
Ah,
mostly. Uh-huh. And these were slaves who had been hired out, so they have an element of freedom. And they not only are they hired out, but they are living in their own quarters. So they can actually use that as a cover.
Now, see, this is interesting because I think most people, when they think of slavery, they think of it as a rural, agrarian, working farms, working big houses, as domestic servants. But, of course, in the cities, there would be domestic servants, too. And it sounds like they had a greater sense of autonomy, probably because of the urban quarters.
They were called quasi-free because they had all the freedom to hire themselves out. They would pay their master a percentage of their earnings over an extended period of time. It's usually contracted, although it's not legally binding, but it is contracted. And that customary contract is what people used in order to not only maintain their property, but also to get some benefits from having their property hiring out themselves. Now, that meant that particularly in urban areas, there were lots of free spaces created by these people. If the master gets his or her money, she doesn't really care what the slave is doing with his time.
And then,
of course, the system then saw that as a point of vulnerability because they can't control these people in ways that they want to control them.
Well, I would certainly think they still had that lack of freedom of movement beyond the city itself where they lived.
Yes, but within the city, they created a hell of a problem because these people moved about. Not only did they move about, but they also associated with free blacks. They associated with working class whites. And you would get periodically in the newspapers, attempts to clamp down on this association. And it would succeed for a while, but then you would see it would disappear from the accounts of the newspapers, and then a year or two later it would turn up again. So there are periodic attempts by the authorities to control these connections across the racial lines as well as between slaves and free blacks in these urban communities.
And I can see where Southern authorities would see that as just a major source of subversiveness towards the slavery system at that point.
Yes.
My guest today is Richard Blackett, the Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt. He'll be giving the Barnard Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock in the Lorton Performance Center on Into the Belly of the Beast, the Southern Arm of the Underground Railroad. Give us a sense of how a slave would undertake finding the Underground Railroad, being a part of the Underground Railroad, and getting out. Can you give us a sense of how that information was conveyed, how it came to them?
Well, the evidence suggests, we have tended to see this as some kind of a very mysterious, clandestine, behind-the-scenes workings based on rumor and the spread of word of mouth. And I'm sure that's part of the way they communicated with one another. But there's also ample evidence that they wrote letters. Mm-hmm. So these are literate slaves, people who develop a certain degree of literacy while they were enslaved, either, as Frederick Douglass suggests, they did it clandestinely, or in some cases, the master turned a blind eye to whatever it is they were doing. And we have, again, ample evidence that slaves, before they escaped, knew where they were going. There are slaves who say, I am going to New York City because my wife is in New York City, having escaped earlier, and I'm going to join her, or I'm going to Canada where my brother is and who has gotten me a job to work in a local hotel, so that there are those kind of details that we are able to track so that people knew where they were going and they therefore knew the best way to get there. Not always the safest way, but the best way to get there.
It sounds like there was a great deal more communication than most, than the general stereotype about the Underground Railroad was there. Yeah.
Indeed, because there were local attempts, slaveholders locally, particularly in urban areas, were beside themselves in an effort to get local postmasters to control the flow of letters between slaves who had left and those who had been left behind. They were insisting that the postmasters break federal law, open any letter addressed to a free black or slave, and read its content.
Interesting, because that sounds like the government was sort of a, even though there were things like the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, it sounds like the government was in some way a passive partner.
Let's put it slightly differently.
Okay.
The slaves were able to exploit some weak spots in the law in order to achieve what they wanted to achieve. I don't think they were being complacent. Is that in many instances, there's ample evidence that the local authorities simply broke federal law and opened letters and read them.
I see, but
some postmasters refused to do it.
Yeah.
Because they saw it as a violation of their trust and also of their position.
Is there any sense that there were sympathetic Southerners that were helping on the Underground Railroad?
Yeah.
Plenty?
Indeed there were. There were some in places. There individuals in one particular individual in Wilmington, Delaware, who a very rich Quaker who spent an enormous amount of his resources helping slaves to get out, and who was captured in the late 1840s and 1850s and financially broken because of the fines that were imposed on him. But he announced to the court openly, he says, I'll be back financially and I'm going to continue doing this.
Mm.
So yes, there were some, but they're few and far between, understandably.
Now, Quaker, you could understand that, and I would assume he was probably treated as suspect on a regular basis within his community.
Yes, he was known.
Yeah.
But that didn't stop him from doing what he was doing.
No. Any sense of clandestine, maybe even slave owners, that were seeing that this system was rotten, or was the economic necessity of having slaves just too fruitful
that was,
to, you know, I mean, just it was just too economically advantageous to them?
Yes. No. This is the basis of their major resources, financial resources. So, no, I know of no slaveholder who openly or clandestinely aided slaves to escape, either by turning a blind eye or simply not doing anything about it. Now, some didn't, because it was just too, they calculated that it was too financially taxing to actually go after a slave. But that is a different response than somebody who is simply turning a blind eye.
Yeah. How big was the industry of tracking down slavery? Was that a big industry towards, say, late 1840s, and especially after 1850, in the last decade before the Civil War?
Industry might be taking it a little too far, but I think it was well organized. It was a determined effort, and it was, by its very existence, a deeply political organization. There was a purpose behind it to ensure the maintenance of this system, and they did it. They created these organizations, but like many organizations, some of them are short-lived, but some of them are recreated over time. So, yes, when there's a spike in escapes, for instance, from one particular area, border state, you would find the organization among slaveholders to try and stop it.
Mm.
And then I suppose they succeed in some instances, and therefore they disappear from the record, but they turn up later again when there's another spike in runaways.
My guest today is Richard Blackett, the Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt. He'll be giving the Barnard Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock in the Lorton Performance Center on Into the Belly of the Beast, the Southern Arm of the Underground Railroad. This is a part of a continuing series of lectures by the History Department celebrating the sesquicentennial of the Civil War and the issues surrounding it, and certainly slavery and the abolition movement that was combating slavery in the South is, you know, that's right along those lines. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Your work today is looking at how the 1850s Fugitive Slave Act, which made it illegal even in the North to help a slave get to Canada or settle in the North. Of course, this is one of the big acts that led to the Civil War. And you've been looking at how communities either resisted or supported the enforcement of that law. How did this change the Underground Railroad and how slave owners and abolitionists reacted to, you know, slaves leaving the South, escaping from the South.
You sound like you want me to give you a very encapsulated version of my book. And you're trying to affect sales here, or either promote it, and I appreciate it. Look, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law changes the political climate around the issue of slavery. It nationalizes the issue of slavery. Prior to 1850, Southern slaveholders and Southern politicians argued throughout that slavery was a state institution, right, that should be controlled by people in the state, and they must determine whether or not they want to free slaves or what. But the terms of the 1850 law, it nationalized it, it by saying a number of things. One, among many, is that, look, if a slaveholder comes into the North to recapture, or his agent to recapture a slave, and he asks for the assistance of a local person, that local person has to aid in the recapture of the slave. Now, people who have, they could be solidly anti-slavery, they could be partially anti-slavery, they couldn't care two hoots about slavery. This forces them into the position of having to now become a police for a person who, for a system and a person about whom they have no connection, about whom they care little, or against whom they are passionately opposed. So it makes for a different climate, so that when a runaway slave turns up in a northern city or a small community, and he or she is pursued by a slave catcher, you immediately now have tensions within that community. If that place has a black community, because they tended to rally in an effort to make sure that those fugitive slaves are not retaken, and of course that only creates tensions locally again.
I was going to say, it sounds like the act in itself sort of eliminated the middle neutrals, if you will. You either became a partisan or an opponent.
Yes, it did all kind of other things. For instance, all hearings had to be summary. There could be no legal representation for the slave, the accused slave. The accused slave could not have legal representation. The evidence was based solely on what the slaveholder said. If the slaveholder said, "This is my slave, and here I have a warrant for his arrest that take note in Georgia," that is all that is necessary. The person who is here in this case, who is called a commissioner, gets $10 if he sends the person back, but only $5 if he doesn't. The 1850 law is one of those crazy draconian laws that periodically this democratic country finds it necessary to enact. It is nuts. That's as mildly as I could put it.
And it explains some of the language of the 14th Amendment about due process, too.
Sure, and it says something about why communities who looked at this law, particularly in the northern, some northern communities, said, "Over my dead body, would you enforce this law?" It means that we have now heightened levels of political violence around cases that, you know, that are only important because the law says they are important.
Well, we're looking forward to your lecture tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center, the Mary Barnard lecture. Before we go, I know that you were grew up in Trinidad, educated in England, came to the United States. Your interest has always been the Atlantic abolitionist movement, but one of the things you've written is that wherever I am, I try to understand the local history, and being in Nashville, you recently wrote a very interesting article about Montgomery Bell, who was apparently at one point a pretty hard slave owner, and at some point he changed, he freed his slaves, he sent a bunch of slaves to Liberia because he couldn't leave them in Tennessee by state law. And a rather remarkable turnaround.
Well, it wasn't a total turnaround. I mean, Montgomery Bell may have been the largest slaveholder in the state. He had, at one point, he may have had close to 300 slaves. He was a furnace man, built some of the greatest ironworks in this part of sort of Middle Tennessee. And in the early 1850s, at the age of getting on to 85 or thereabouts, Montgomery Bell, who was a bachelor, never married, although he had children, and I leave that to the imagination of your listeners.
Yes.
black and white children, I hasten to add. Montgomery Bell is looking onto the other side and seeing that his family are jostling for his property, and he decides that he's going to, out of sheer cussedness, he's going to undermine their hopes and aspirations.
So there was no altruism involved in this? It was just...
as the guys would say, hell no. And Montgomery Bell decides to start freeing his slaves and sending them over in groups to Liberia. He dies before, he ends up sending about 80-odd of his slaves to Liberia. When he dies, he tries to sell off some of the others in his will, but also in his will he left a bequest for the establishment of the school for indigent boys, which is, as you say, is a remarkable turnaround.
It is. And, of course, that home for indigent boys now is, what
it's
is it?
It's
a prep school, right?
Oh, it's a very, very rich and very well-endowed private academy.
Yes.
In Nashville. That produces excellent students and has a great reputation. But it as I said when I wrote the article, or initially gave, I initially gave this talk as part of a series of lectures at the public library here in Nashville. And that is why there were some people who became very exercised by the fact that I made a sort of slide, some sort of snide remark about the present occupants of Montgomery Bell not being indigent by any stretch of the imagination. So that got me in trouble, but it was only little trouble.
Well, we look forward to your lecture tonight and look forward to your work further on examining the lead up to the Civil War through the Fugitive Slave Law, which I assume will be a future book. Richard Blackett, thanks very much for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Richard Blackett is the Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. He'll be giving the Barnard Lecture at the University of Tulsa, sponsored by the Department of History, on Into the Belly of the Beast, the Southern Arm of the Underground Railroad. It takes place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Scott Gregory here. Just wanted to remind you the Barnard Lecture, the lecture in connection with the interview we've just heard, will happen tomorrow night, Thursday night, the 21st at 7 p.m. It's been rescheduled because of the weather. It's tomorrow at 7 in the Lorton Performance Center at TU.